What's up, everybody? Welcome to The Gods Will Not Save You, The Wire Revisited. My name is Willie Romano Pugh.
Hey there, my name's Jakob. This is a podcast where we will do a deep read into each and every episode of the hit show, The Wire. Thanks for coming back, everyone.
That's right. Thank you so much. Always appreciated. Just a quick reminder here at top. If you have any money that you want to kick our way, just kick it into our little donation bin. You could find us at anchor.fm/thegodswillnotsaveyou/support. Always helpful. And while you're at it, be sure to give us a 5-star review on iTunes to boost our confidence and our position in the algorithm.
Yeah. Twofer.
There we go.
All prologue, baby.
Season
Amazing
two
episode.
Season 2, episode 6.
Yeah. There you go. Thanks. All prologue. Amazing episode. It's like a finale in the middle of the season, right? Is that kind of the
We got a major character's death, like in an episode, you know, smack dab in the middle of the season. It's kind of uncharacteristic for a lot of TV shows for something that big to happen.
It's a hard episode to stomach, especially because of, you know, Dee being such an amazing character, and you know, we've seen his evolution also. You know, Larry Gilliard Jr., well regarded, he's like the actor's actor of the show and so forth. Everyone was really fond of him, and he's obviously very talented. Obviously it's at the center of the episode, even though we got a lot of big things taking place Simon fashion. You know, we kind of get some little hints that, you know, since Dee is kind of reflecting and, you know, taking a look at his son and flushing drugs down the toilet, that something might be amiss.
Yeah. It's it follows the classic Wire playbook of signaling that somebody who's trying to do good or is trying to get their life together is gonna end up dead, because that's the way the things go in these parts here. If you show disloyalty to your employer in any fashion, whether you're a cop or you're a mid-level drug dealer, you're gonna get screwed. So it's only natural that this episode really plays up the whole innocence angle, or maybe, like, you know, yearning for reform angle of D'Angelo's character. Only for our expectations to be, our you know, confidence to be crushed by seeing the hope snuffed away of D'Angelo living a straight life. Like, as you mentioned, we see him flushing drugs down the toilet. Although, you know, from a practical standpoint, it didn't really seem like he was hiding them that well. That he just, like, he scotch taped some folded up pieces of paper containing heroin to his, like, toilet bowl, which, like, I feel like even a cursory inspection by one of the prison guards would get him in a lot of hot water. But, you know, that's fine. Like, good for him. You know, it's a big step forward. Did he get that after there was, like, the outbreak of the hot shots or whatever? Like, did he get those drugs? Like, he saw all those people, like, overdosing and dying from the poisoned heroin. And then he was like, he just was like, okay, I'm going to wait a little while and then I'll buy some. I'll, like, get some more.
Yeah. Lightning can't strike twice, right? So, but yeah, I mean, that's a great point. I didn't like you know, from a tactical perspective, I mean, I'm thinking that it has to be after, right? Because in the midst of all the, you know, the midst of the investigation surrounding the hotshots, you know, unless he just completely forgot about him, you'd think that everyone would be getting searched and so forth. So having those around during that time would be really disadvantageous. But maybe it's also that he's Avon's nephew and they obviously know, you know, he holds such, you know, or he's so high up in the prison hierarchy that maybe he's worked out a deal with the guards to leave D'Angelo alone. Or we know that's not how he helps out D. He more so, like, kills his friends with tainted drugs. And that's his love, as you've discussed.
But I mean, we're splitting hairs here, of course, but like, it's a good scene that shows him flushing the drugs down, because read by like his performance read is, it's a high empathy performance. So in that moment, I'm able to suspend disbelief of him like foolishly buying drugs after the epidemic of overdoses, and just kind of like get on board with his character's intentions. And it's a great testament to his acting prowess that it's that effective. Speaking of acting prowess, how about that scene with his mom? Oof. Gets me every time. I'm not gonna lie, like I get a little choked up when I see that scene.
Yeah, it's, I mean, amazing. All the way down the board, from the, you know, acting and the interaction, the gravity of the moment, encapsulating that and their performances, and just the casting, which everyone talks about how Michael Hyatt and like Larry Gilliard Jr. look like they could be, you know, related. A family.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, but it's also the energy and the performance, of course, that's so powerful.
Yeah. And once again, there's like complicated layers to the arguments that both of them are making, because we can see the humanity coming from Brianna and wanting her son to be like home and safe and secure. But at the same time, like, you know, she's pleading with him to side with his uncle, even though she's fully aware of like the nefarious practices that Avon is involved with. And then D'Angelo brings up this story, this like really heartbreaking story of how she like locked him out of the house when he was like getting bullied by neighborhood kids. And he's like pleading to get outside, and she tells him to go face them himself, and he gets the shit beat out of him. And he's like bringing it, and it's like, you know, when a lot of like reasonable people would hear that story, they'd be kind of like horrified at the parenting tactics involved. But the way D'Angelo brings it up, it's kind of like it's a lesson he's learned from his childhood that he's applying to the situation he's in now. And he's like trying to throw it back at his mom, that he's learned this lesson of self-reliance from her, even though it's like a totally sociopathic thing for her to do. And now she's either like recognizing that it might have been a fucked up lesson that she was teaching, or that she's like realizing that he's like finally grown up and he's being responsible enough to take this on the chin. It's a complex array of emotions she's displaying as she's crying. She's still evil as fuck, but
thanks for reminding us.
It's a great testament to you know, the miracle workers of this show, that we can empathize with her in this moment, knowing everything we know.
Yeah, I mean, speaking about knowing things, when Dee's like mom, you know, it was Avon who was behind those hot shots, and she kind of gives him a look. I mean, as you said, she's obviously aware, because she's complicit in the operation, this family business, more or less. And to your point, the tough lesson, tough story to hear. But it's kind of, I like the quote or the statement that, you know, that they share. It's like, I brought you in this world, but instead of, and I can take you out, it's, and you're going to have to live in it. So I think that's a, you know, a great way to sum up, you know, like, hey, you're here now, so you got to face the bullies or face whatever challenges come your way. But yeah, it's pretty tough to see, especially knowing everything that's about to transpire, how he's basically telling her to, but he's like,
leave him be.
He's like on the verge of placing himself in a like figurative solitary confinement, where he doesn't want any contact with his kid, who he just took a, like, it was his last glimpse at his son, which, I mean, he'll be killed shortly, but he was, you know, it was like his mental preparation to walk away from his entire family, not knowing that the man who's going to kill him is actually watching the entire conversation. like how it would be up to Stringer to find, you know, in his cold-blooded ways of orchestrating this murder, to find like the most sociopathic hitman or whatever you want to call it, who will just like, right, hang out and yeah, like, yeah, I'll watch him. Like, what kind of murderer would say, oh, I'm going to kill this guy, let me watch him talk to his mom and place myself, yeah, like in every, let me, yeah, place myself around this guy at every opportunity I have, because
like the long game. Yeah.
Yeah. It doesn't make, like, are there no cameras? Like, hey, this, yeah, guy was following D around all day.
In the long game, he had to play with like arranging to have a visitor at the exact same time D'Angelo had a visitor, and to sit right next, yeah, to him. Like, who is he talking to on the other end of the glass?
It's just like, the more witnesses, the better, I guess. That makes the hiding in plain sight taken to the extreme.
Yeah. And I also think it's really sad that it's so obvious that Brianna wanted to hug D'Angelo in that moment, and they're separated by the glass, and she just like is touch, like she's like putting her hand on the glass, like wanting to like touch him and like say goodbye to him. And
then, yes. Put your hand up to the Zoom screen, ready?
And her hand just like lingered there on the glass for a moment, even after he walked away. Like, she kind of knows in that moment that like she might never see him again under normal circumstances, because he's basically drawing a line in the sand between him and his own family. But even in that moment, she can't even fathom how tragic it's going to be for her, you know, within the next couple days.
Brutal stuff. And then he has one last encounter with Avon as well. And the setup for that scene is pretty spellbinding and,
yeah,
you know, well placed.
Yeah, it's pretty heartbreaking. There's not even any words of dialogue spoken by D'Angelo. He's just serving him cold looks when Avon tries to get his attention when they're passing each other in the hall. And we, yeah, see the camera kind of like drifting away from Avon, almost from D'Angelo's perspective of, you know, signifying him permanently walking away from that relationship. So it's not long after that, yeah, that we see this farewell, so to speak, is when D'Angelo gets what's coming to him.
Yeah, he gets killed in the library where he seems to be happily, you know, working.
Right.
It's a setting where we've seen him previously with one of his buddies who was presumably killed by one of the hotshots, and he, yeah, seems to enjoy it more or less. And he had also just taken part in a look like some sort of book club or, mm-hmm, schooling. Maybe it's an official class he could take for credit, who knows? But, you know, the conversation in that is very symbolic of you know, what's about to,
yeah,
take place, or D'Angelo's attempts to make a change. And you know, talking about the tides and maybe representing the undertow and so forth that's constantly pulling at him.
Yeah, they have an extended conversation about the Great Gatsby in that book club led by a novelist himself and future Wire staff writer Richard Price.
Yes.
You know, D'Angelo is becoming very bookish in prison. You know, he's approaching it in the right way. Just keep his head down and read as much as you can, because not a lot else you can do. And he sees some valuable lessons in classic literature that he can apply to his own life. And he's sharing it very earnestly with his other classmates.
Taking us back to like, what is that, a 10th grade English novel? Or
yeah, I think it might have been my junior year that I read that.
Yeah. I can't really remember. I was a little,
but yeah.
Let's just say I didn't have half the understanding that D has at this moment, but obviously it's like, I can't make any comparisons to his life, but he's obviously living a much more intense existence. Just a really somber episode, and
yeah,
that scene, pretty brutal, especially the way that, I mean, I'm assuming, yeah, it's set up to be a look like a suicide. Sure Stringer wanted that to be like his legacy as well, if that's some sort of practical, whatever you want to call it, tactic, or it's just, what he thought would be the most plausible in a jail setting, especially because he's taken part in manipulating D'Angelo and his psyche to where people would believe it more that he killed himself, knowing that he was facing what he was.
But yeah, it's a really intense scene involving D'Angelo's death. He had been saying, like, many times throughout the show up until this point, like, I gotta go outside and get some air, or I feel like I can't breathe, because he's being kind of like suffocated from the fucked up hierarchy that he's been born into and has had to deal with all his life. So to watch him being strangled that violently, it could only mean that it's like a metaphorically linked to his proclamations throughout the show of, you know, not being able to get air or whatnot. But yeah, the like how they just kind of like end it with, the killer like ties the belt around his neck and then around the doorknob. And there's like a really like clumsy like exit from this where he has to like hold on to D'Angelo's head against the door while he's like sneaking out so that like he doesn't like bump into him or like mess up the scene. And then after the door closes, you just see D'Angelo's body like slide down into the position where it looks like he could have hung himself. And it's just like a brutal, like, it's almost like the writer and director of this episode are just like twisting the knife in your stomach to show you like, oh yeah, just in case you thought there's any chance that D'Angelo could survive, no, we're going to give you a extra close-up shot of his dead face just to rub it in.
Yeah,
no hope.
Nope. That's a show with no hope, as Simon dubbed it, right?
I mean we can get on to like one of the other major set pieces of the show is Omar's trial appearance. Oh, yeah. Very delicious, just great. You know, this show has got some ups, but boy howdy does it got a lot of downs. There's a lot of depressing stuff to ruminate on this show that's just all about like how justice is not gonna work in anybody's favor the majority of the time, and just to see Omar go toe to toe with a lawyer and kind of shame him in his own court was a really satisfying moment, I gotta tell you. Let's talk a little bit about it.
Like you said, it's the show's always highlighting the failures of the justice system in such brilliant ways, and this is probably the most it's the most probably famous scene of them all, right?
So yeah, but it's,
I mean, we know, yeah, kind of it flips Levy on his head, or the character that has been established has always been one step ahead and doing the carrying water for this violent organization. And of course it's not necessarily a show where good and evil are easily discerned. So it's not like you're always rooting for the cops and situations, but I mean, it's pretty obvious, Levy's greasiness.
Yeah.
But to see him get owned by Omar, who we know he's sharp, especially the way they set up this courtroom interaction is so brilliant, because for one thing, he doesn't care about a dress code and he has his tie is the only thing he bought from the voucher that he was provided. So I guess when you have a drunk chaperone like McNulty trying to help you suit shopping, you just come back with a nice tie. I mean, it was, he was flossing the tie, but also we see Omar's just how, smart he is in a different light, aside from street savvy. He's kind of reflecting on his time as a youth and what we can assume is, especially based on some of the things he'll say in the courtroom, tumultuous childhood, one of uncertainty, and he kind of found his solace in this Greek mythology. So Interesting touch, especially like the god of war being Ares. You know, we know Omar is fierce.
Yeah, we see it. We see him give the correct answer to a crossword puzzle that, like, you know, court guard or security,
maybe like a bailiff. Maybe.
Yeah, we see him give the answer to a crossword puzzle question that he's having trouble with. He talks about Greek mythology, and it kind of like that kind of like ties into David Simon and Ed Burns's whole MO that they're constantly trying to refer back to the Greeks in their storytelling structure. Because, well, you know, and there's also the character of the Greek this season. But
this is the first time I've, you know, made that connection. So if nothing else comes out of this venture, I'm like, I finally made the connection, the Greek and the Greek tragedies.
Yeah.
What is it?
Yeah, exactly. David Simon has said that, like, he's been more inspired by like Greek tragedies than Shakespearean tragedies, because Shakespearean tragedy is all about, like, you know, psychological individual choices that lead to people's downfall. But with this, it's more institutional in showing that there is going to be tragedy and downfall and all that. But it's more of a institutional problem than an individual problem, where people are just born into these respective positions in society and their fate is inevitable. He's said before that the institutions in this show are kind of like the Greek gods throwing down lightning bolts on the characters. But yeah, so Omar is brought on as a witness in the whole William Gant case to identify Bird as the murderer. And while he's being cross-examined by Levy, Levy is kind of giving him the third degree and trying to like delegitimize his position on the witness stand by calling him amoral and, you know, saying he's a parasite. Omar is able to effectively turn the tables on him, so to speak, and argue in front of the court and the jury that Levy is just as much of a villain as he is. It's a pretty powerful scene that kind of gives the audience a window into how people in positions of what we would think of as legitimate power can be just as corruptible. In a lot of ways, I feel like that trope has been kind of like tired out by this point. You know, it's like 17 years since this episode came out. And there's been like lots of comparisons like, oh no, the lawyers, they're the real criminals, or like the people in charge, those are the real criminals, which is like, you know, I'm sure we've all heard stuff like that a million times by now, but The Wire was one of the first bit to do it, baby, and they did it beautifully.
And what can you say? I mean, you got jury duty coming up, maybe, right?
That's right. I just got a summons. Does
watching a scene like this maybe give you some confidence that your experience could be like a all-time illuminating one, and
let me see,
you could be treated to such a show, like maybe you have a modern day Omar out there that you just haven't been able to observe.
I think I'm gonna write to the Superior Court of California County of Los Angeles and let them know, if Omar Little is not gonna be on the witness stand, then I'm not showing up. It's non-negotiable. Come and get me, all right? Also, we're in the middle of a pandemic and I'm scared of being indoors.
Oh man, I can see that. Like, jury duty, I have jury duty. That's your worst nightmare. Well, I mean, like I said, you're a very civic-minded individual. I mean, you may be the only person I know that would get maybe remotely excited to participate in you know, your mandated duty to serve the justice system. And also probably get excited over like an NPR pledge drive, but that's a whole different story.
NPR pledge drive? Come on. I only need to hear the
remember
message.
We were driving to Vegas and you're like, y'all want to hear something that really slaps? You're like, Siri, replay that NPR pledge drive track.
Yeah.
That's it. I, the delivery wasn't, it was better when it really happened.
We get to get a little glimpse into Omar and Birds's fractured relationship when he fingers him from the witness stand. And I like what you have written here, that Fredro Starr goes full Onyx in this in this episode.
Oh yeah, we get a taste of his fierce nature, in case you've forgotten. But if you watch one of his videos, yeah, it's part of that rap group. You could see him, you know, channeling it. I mean, yeah, he doesn't hold back. Anyone can get it. Omar, Kima, you know.
Yeah.
But you know, Omar's just teasing him, and their background having jailed together down at the Cut, meaning Jessup, Maryland, the correctional facility there, and which it's been alluded to in the past, but you know, Omar, he knows the game, and we get this discussion surrounding, you know, his morality. And as you discussed brilliantly, this is, you know, a tie-in to Simon's love for kind of modeling or structuring things after these Greek tragedies. And this is definitely one of Omar's high points, you know, and maybe his apex, as far as, you know, I've never turned my gun on no taxpayer and things like that, where, you know, someone who's openly talking about carrying out armed robberies and even shooting someone, Mike in his hind parts, can still be perceived as a, you know, like a lovable guy. Like, people are like, I go have a beer with this guy. I mean, he's got a foot long scar across his face. He's talking about shooting people, but he's a nice guy. It's all in the game.
Stringer was in the courtroom to hurl homophobic slurs at Omar. And, you know, it doesn't stop there, with Bird calling him a lying C word sucker and telling him that telling him he's going to shiv him in jail. And it's just, you know, showcasing brilliant acting work of Omar, that he doesn't buck in the face of pressure. He's got all these people just like hurling horrible things at him, and he just kind of like sticks his heels in and gives it to the justice system the best way he knows how to.
Yeah, true that. But hurling, I know it's like it's like more of a figurative manner, because I mean, from my, like, maybe I'm a literal learner. I take things very literally. So I'm like, okay, you know, Bird, you know, extreme with his slander. But, you know, like, if you say Strings hurling them, he's not necessarily like standing.
Yeah.
He's just kind of talking subtly to, you know, McNulty, which, by the way, I mean, aside from it, yeah, it is reprehensible what he's talking about. But we've seen him say worse about Omar, especially in front of Avon and the guys. But,
right,
you know, Stringer's talking about he was over on Ashland Avenue, which we've heard referenced previously. Mm-hmm. I'll refrain from like, this is what gets me, Greek tragedies and all this stuff. Okay. Ooh, Ashland Avenue. No. Geography? It's like the most important iconic scene in the show. I'm like, oh, did you hear that? He was sticking them up on Ashland Avenue. Yes. Great writing. Phenomenal. No, but you know, String knows what's up. He's like, man, this guy, touche, he's one upping us here with this, you know, fabricated testimony, but it's all true. I mean, it's all to be believed. Never once, aside, you know, it's like this happened, you know,
right.
Definitely what Bird did. However, Omar, he wasn't there, but you know, all in the game, right? So game recognized game, I guess, but
an appropriate segue to kind of get into Jimmy's storyline.
You know, he's kind of trying to move on from this Jane Doe investigation. Yeah. And, you know, we kind of learn more about the motives behind that, which we'll get into, I'm sure, shortly. But what I'm trying to say here is, I'm sure our conversations will circle back to these, you know, like I said, motivations behind why Jimmy's ditching this investigation into Jane Doe. Or they may just take place right now because I lost my train of thought on where I'm going. Basically, I mean, it may be an attempt to, you know, try to get back with his estranged wife, or, you know, fooling himself into thinking he's living this quiet life on the waterfront, catching crabs during the day, and, you know, maybe wants to be the family man that he never has been able to be. Or, you know, he's like he tells Bunk, you know, this was just my way of, you know, trying to like, what is it?
Wrap it.
Help me out here. Well, yeah. He's trying to fool himself that he's not a cop or homicide.
Yeah. I mean, it's, it kind of also beautifully wraps up the whole parallel thing he has going on with D'Angelo, because as we see in the first episode, they're kind of on respective tracks in their own institutions. And then in this episode, we see Jimmy taking on a kind of similar strategy to D'Angelo, where he's, you know, saying to the people that are closely involved in his life, like, I'm walking away from this family, and I'm going to try to like settle down and start something new. And I'm going to be a family man now. Like I want to move back in with you and raise the kids. But we both see that those consequences are going to catch up to both of them, you know, of course, with D'Angelo in a much more tragic, brutal, vicious way. But with McNulty, his opportunity for growth is going to be denied to him because his wife just knows the kind of person he is, and she's ever reluctant to fully take him back, even if she is just interested in a one night stand after a waterfront dinner.
Yeah, and she sticks to the one for the road mantra and tells him that she doesn't even want him to be seen by their son. So
I mean, can you blame her?
Exactly. Jimmy, yeah, he's a dog for sure. And yeah, he and Bunk have one of their classic scenes, like drunk on the railroad tracks, which is where we learn about Jimmy you know, talking, basically admitting that it was all really just about his own ego and being a murder police, where you're kind of like, this had nothing to do really with trying to help out that woman. I mean, even if it did, I mean, there was some humanity involved, but
yeah,
he needs the chase. So, I mean, it just happened that the vessel for that was Jane Doe, who, you know, is going to get cut up now and be utilized by students in the ME's office. But like he says, Frasier, right? Or the ME, you know, it's not fair.
What
in life is.
I mean, I think we
blacked out.
We get a glimpse into Jimmy's humanity and his desire to do right by this unidentified woman when, you know, he's looking at her corpse and he's just like taking one last look at her, realizing he's failed to get her identified and for like any family to have like a proper grieving process and all that. So, you know, you can tell that he does feel a little bad about that. So, you know, we give McNulty a lot of flack on this podcast, but I'm willing to give him a little bit of credit on this one, that he wanted some sort of closure for this lady. Yeah,
I feel it. The amount of work that's gone into trying to figure out who she is, you know, while it may be self-serving, it can't be understated. You know, I mean, he's an addict for the job. Yeah. So it's like, oh, it's very admirable of you, sir, to drive to New Jersey. However, you know, you don't really have a life, even though he's trying to try to manufacture what's left of, you know, a potential marriage and being a dad and in a more traditional family sense. But, you know, he needs this. So whatever closure may be found here, I'm not sure, but I don't think anyone's really convinced with him. And like you said, brilliantly bringing up the parallels with D'Angelo, we'll come to see that he'll be back on the case investigating his death. So yeah. I don't know. I mean, at least, you know, he's got Bunk's back, right? He doesn't want Bunk to start shooting his service weapon.
Yeah. But speaking of Bunk, I feel like that's a unless you have more things you want to say about McNulty, I feel like we could transition to talking about him in the details storyline.
They've gotten the port administrator to somehow, he's agreed or she's agreed to give them a model of what they utilize as far as the checkers are concerned. And then they, you know, all the work they do and determining the patterns kind of lead to the idea where, yeah, they'll utilize this computer system to create a clone a la the payphones, more or less.
Right. And it's a very painstaking work, as evidenced by their behavioral patterns when checking all the cans that are coming in on those shitty computer graphics.
Hey, Beatty's really really good on the computer. She's been kind of looked at by Bunk, maybe some sort of judgmental way. But she's, proving that someone who, as in her own words, looked to being a cop as a way to provide for her, to her kids, and, being a single parent, and, you don't necessarily just have to want to be or be natural police, as, it's like a theme on the show that, she's like more of a technician and, showing them what's up. They're like, damn, we could have used her on the first season, I guess.
Yeah. She's really coming into her own with becoming, a great cop. She's also excelling at ruthlessly shutting down Herc's half-assed advances with a swift raise of her personal coffee mug to refute his invitation to sit for a cup of coffee. Yeah, man, we're witnessing Beatty's growth. Her exponential growth in this episode as a person and as a professional.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know how much professionalism can be factored in. It's like, just as a woman, fending off Herc, who has this, I guess, a panty fetish and wants to make a soup. Maybe more so, of course, not discrediting how uncomfortable of a situation that would be, especially that I was cramming the late stages of a sexual harassment training mandated by my job in between watching this episode. So that definitely,
kind of
definitely some protocols that did not manifest in that situation. As far as Carver, not delivering maybe an eye message to Herc about that. Although his look at Herc maybe shows some of his growth too, right?
Maybe.
Because in the past, I mean, he is one or two episodes removed from dropping some F-bombs in the gay slur type of way. But at least he's not joking about panty soup with Herc.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know. For what it's worth, whatever. But so the detail is, closing in on Frank. They have the paper trail dream team, if you will, up on the records of the IBS, which they don't even need a subpoena for, due to how much shenanigans and just overall malarkey that they are constantly involved in.
There you go. Way to keep it current.
Yeah. I don't even know if I use the right context. I only watched one and a half of the debate.
But it's really, really telling that when Frank Sabatka brings up the issues at the IBS meeting, saying like, oh yeah, we got some friendly campaign donations and some generous givers, blah, blah, blah. And Nat Coxon like automatically calls him on his bullshit, because it's like kind of like a open secret that they are kind of like a little bit corrupt. They might fucking be getting some money where they shouldn't be getting from, and most people probably already know it. So no surprise that the detail is catching on to this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, Nat knows what's up. I mean, he just wants that grain pier, but Frank wants that canal dredged, but Yeah, that, I mean, we get some pretty classic stevedore moments this episode. You know, we get to see the dynamics of the meeting. It's pretty confusing the first few times watching some of these scenes involving the stevedores. You're just like, wait, what? They head to the bar, just like the usual run-of-the-mill stevedore talk, trashing a partially deaf colleague. right? It's like, yeah. These are my guys. No.
but we have
Herc missed his calling. That's all I got to say.
To be a stevedore?
Yeah.
I feel like he complains to like I don't know if he'd be able to like hang with that workload.
Yeah, it's better for the I don't know. I mean, it's like either or. You got the Baltimore public who will suffer and be injured and hurt by Herc or potentially, you know, killed, or one of the IBS members. He just like, I don't feel like lifting this lever, da da da. And then someone gets a can dropped on their face. Sorry.
It's a dangerous job.
Yeah, definitely. But I mean, they know that those who are, you know, not just solely focused on where they're going to get drunk, which one of the whatever 3 dozen bars, 50 bars that they could go to, you know, those who are in tune with what might actually be taking place are aware of all, like Frank's towing the dangerous line with his corruption and involvement in crime. So
like, yeah, Nat, I mean, like Nat says, watch your ass, Frank.
Exactly. And they're like making jokes about robbing liquor stores and stuff while Frank's, you know, legitimately in bed with some of the biggest criminals in Baltimore or potentially that, you know, Atlantic seaboard area, the mid-Atlantic.
Right.
I'll just go with the region, you know, that is, you know, on the thumbnail for the TED Talks, like TED mid-Atlantic. Oh, it has Baltimore in it? Okay. Mid-Atlantic it is. Nice. But I mean, since we're talking about the bar scene and, you know, Ziggy showing his whole ass burning hundos in front of working stiffs, which leads to Frank removing himself, which was a little surprising. I don't know. I thought he would, you know, go after Ziggy right there, but he's already, I guess, shattered some of their, not shattered, but he's already hit him, and apparently that's a thing that Ziggy's not letting go of easily, as we see their interaction outside of the bar, where Frank has been patiently waiting to talk to his very inebriated son.
Yeah, and this conversation kind of like also, you know, thematically ties back into the conversation D'Angelo has with Brianna, where I feel like a parental figure is maybe coming to terms with mistakes that they had made in raising their children the right way. It's kind of fucked up that both Ziggy and D'Angelo were brought into, you know, lifestyles that they weren't really equipped for or ready for.
Yeah. But whereas D'Angelo, yeah, well, he's walking away before he's tragically murdered, Ziggy kind of has this I don't know what you would call it, but
he's on a bad path.
You know, he has this cognitive dissonance in a way, or I don't know if I'm using that term properly, as far as his nostalgia for the way the docks were and his family's unable to separate you know, what's going on in a practical sense, whereas Nick, who's also involved in these crimes, is able to see the writing on the wall. He's like, no, I don't want to go to community college and
maybe I should have
coding, dad.
Maybe I should have taken you to the community college like your mom was always. No, that's a terrible. I can't.
No, like your brother. So he has a brother, which I mean, thankfully if we saw him, we know that was, you know, the beginning of his demise, but he's off doing his thing at community college because, yeah, I mean, they don't, I don't want to give away too much geo stuff here, but they don't live in the city. Whereas it looks like Nick and, you know, his brother, Frank's brother, do. They're kind of out in the suburbs. So, and you know, it's like Ziggy's really chomping at the bit to lead this criminal lifestyle, which you've talked about in previous episodes, how he kind of has this Scarface, image in his mind. It's like this delusional whatever. It's pretty wild.
We see that exemplified a lot in this episode, because Nick kind of works overtime behind the scenes and meets with Prop Joe to work out a deal with Cheese so that the debt is forgiven and that, you know, Ziggy doesn't have to get killed and whatnot. So then when Nick gives him money back, minus what, you know, was going on with the car, Ziggy still has to complain that he should be getting more back because the car was worth more than that. And when they do the deal with Spiros and give him the chemicals and they think they're going to get the money, and he says like, oh, well, I could also like give this, I can either give you the money or I can give you a supply of heroin. Ziggy is really eager to get that H and slang it on the streets and turn around to profit, even though we've been shown that he's not capable of doing some hardcore shit like that very effectively.
Yeah, ungrateful Ziggy, man. Gets $2,400 for fucking up a package. I mean, still can't even say thank you, really. And
yeah,
just immediately starts lighting it on fire, maybe in a protest to seeing, having Princess. Well, he didn't see it because he's too scared to venture to that Cheese's turf, but maybe that's his protest for Princess being burned, or he's just psychotic as well.
Right.
But, yeah, like you said, Nick being more practical, taking half money, half cash, half dope. Basically, you know, as we saw some parallels between D'Angelo and, you know, his relationship with his mom and Frank and Ziggy's father-son relationship, Nick has talked to Sergey, who's, you know, the reason why that Nick and Ziggy are still alive. But right, they also, you know, kind of commiserate Prop Joe and Nick about their out of control family members.
Yeah.
Prop Joe's nephew, of course, Cheese. And, you know, we know who Nick's dealing with. So it's like some, just before we move on, of course, we got to acknowledge the brilliance of Robert F. Chu, rest in peace. And yeah, his work as Prop Joe, some of those quotations, especially because we're nearing the holidays, do they hit a little harder? You know?
Yeah.
You know, you can't just pop a cap in them and not hear about it come Thanksgiving, right?
Right. Yeah.
Oh, man. Just classic. I could watch Robert F. Chu all day.
Absolutely. You know, what a great guy. Unsung
Sergey.
Yeah. Unsung hero of season 4 also for getting those kids the acting coaching. But anyway, yeah, Proposition Joe makes a reluctant agreement with Nick and tells him that if he wasn't Sergey's friend, he'd be a cadaverous motherfucker.
That's exactly how he says it.
You're going to be a cadaverous,
motherfucker. Oh, man. But he doesn't let him slide, though. That's what I love about it. He's like, I'm reasonable. I just like to fix clocks and TVs and so forth. But
yeah, what is it?
You're coming here fucking up a package and you're asking for me to help? Like, you just broke the rule number one. Oh, maybe. I don't know where the rule hierarchy is, but I'm sure, you know, complaining after fucking up a package about, you know, the consequences is probably up there with no snitching. So
yeah. Sergey's friendship must mean a lot to Prop Joe that he is able to use that as bargaining and in trying to clear Nick's name. You know what I mean?
An unlikely friendship. And he calls him a term. Well, I was going to talk about it later, but I got to stop doing this. But yeah, that term he calls him, Tobarish, is like comrade, or it's, you know, harkens back to the old country. It's like colleague, friend, mate. Maybe it's the Ukrainian or Russian term for what Prop Joe says after in the American yeah. sense, urban sense. Yeah, exactly. we'll check in with our Ukrainian connects. I doubt it, but that'd be an awkward G-chat question or DM.
There you go.
But I don't want to get into all that because it's really hurt reading and these, you know, novelists or writers I look up to, Pelicanos and Simon respectively, but then knowing that if I ever wanted to do something like that, I have to somehow get comfortable with repeatedly writing the N-word over and over. So I can't do it really. So call me a snowflake, Willie. But that corner, I'll tell you what, man. I guess there was pre-evolution to the ending of that phrase, and it was just like a hard ending to
hurt.
It's like, oh Jesus. It does hurt though, the statements he makes, like Sergey, for lack of a better term, ribbing Prop Joe about his weight and making fun of the American culture of supermarkets, especially knowing that Robert F. Chu, you know, had a lot of health issues, which eventually led to his
untimely demise.
Which, you know, possibly centered around his weight. So
in America, supermarkets are cathedrals. Is that what he says? Right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. He said just that. Yeah. Okay. Well, now that we know, we're just digressing. Now that we've learned that he's not Ukrainian or Russian, the actor
Chris from Virginia.
He's like, he's from the, as Michael K. Williams said, the backwoods or something. But that's my boy, though. That's my boy.
Yeah.
He's a Virginian.
Great job, though. Could have fooled me.
Yeah. Could have fooled the local militias into thinking he's some operative, too. So let's hope he's not trying to storm some, Capitol steps out there and he's just, you know, just chilling.
Yeah. Right. Chardine and Kima going to the strip club together with Prez. Woo!
Prez, I'm not comfortable around women. Yeah. But I like, you know, I dabble in police brutality and but I'm a good guy. This is too much for me and my character. You know, I got a backbone after all.
Right. So Kima and Cheryl, off of a tip from Chardine, go to this one strip club where a lot
night
of
shift.
What's that?
Sorry, night shift. I'm just like, Tourette's strip club, Tourette night shift, $2 steak special.
But they go to this club to question one of the dancers about some of the girls from different countries that have been, you know, dropped off there to go make money in some nefarious, you know, weird, bizarre human trafficking scheme. Cheryl gets really jealous that Kima's going to a strip club. Kima says, you know, I'm just not going down there to look at pussy. It reveals some important details about what exactly was going on with these girls, but also furthers the rift between Cheryl and Kima in their already tumultuous relationship. As you noted, Prez is acting really weird in the presence of naked women, like looking like he's almost about to like throw up or pass out. And we we get some great interaction with this dancer who's she's kind of confirming Cheryl's suspicions that this would not be somewhere that you would want to leave a significant other by themselves. I guess.
You know, Kima kind of have this comedic interaction where Cheryl's like, I'm coming too. Yeah. And, you know, Prez is there acting.
Looking queasy or whatnot. It's just funny that Kima and Cheryl are kind of like taking jabs at him for being so comically uncomfortable.
I mean, maybe it's also like, you know, he's not maybe like we see his wife later on. She definitely does not like you know, take after anyone that he's around in the club. Yeah. You know, he's just surrounded by black women at a strip club. Like, two of them are lesbians. Maybe the stripper is too. I mean, I don't know. Maybe she's bi. I don't know. But she talked about, like, I wouldn't let my girl come here either, you know, alone. Right. So, there's a lot going on. I mean, Prez is pretty much a square bear too, right? So,
yeah.
Whatever.
But I really love, so there's a lot of tension going on with Kima and Cheryl. Cheryl did not have a good experience going to this, you know, accompanying her girlfriend on this little work trip to the strip club. So then Kima, in an effort to like kind of appeal to her humanity, shows her, the stacks of cans at the port and tries to explain to her like the logistics of how these girls suffocated to death, and kind of an appeal to her humanity, and also as a rationale of why she's pursuing this case so hard to find justice.
Yeah, what do you think about Cheryl's reaction? Because I don't want to look into it too hard, but it's kind of like, okay, you know, this is obviously as bad as it gets, or, you know, the way that they died and just the brutality of this case, you know, especially the way she describes it to Cheryl. But, and I'm not trying to say that Cheryl's not, you know, feeling empathetic or taken aback by the horror of this reality, but the way she walks away, is there anything in that reaction that maybe speaks to some of the underlying tensions and how she may perceive Kima's, you know, motives, or, you know, why she's showing her this at all?
I mean, I could just only imagine what it'd be like to be the spouse of someone who would take on such a dangerous job, so that even if your spouse was like trying their darndest to appeal to your humanity, that the love for your part, like, I feel like her love for her partner and her worry just like supersedes all of that, and she's willing to like look past the moral monstrosity that this all is, if it means that it could just have her have Kima to herself. You know, she doesn't want to feel like she's sharing her with like another work family
or gangsters and strippers.
Yeah, right.
But I don't know, maybe I was being super callous in this moment where I'm like, oh, she just sees this as Kima's attempt to, you know, like rationalize future philandering or stuff like that. Like she's, Kima's too neat in her setup for this. Like, oh, see, like, you know, this is what I do and this is why I do it. But in reality, maybe she has ulterior motives for showing Cheryl this side of her job, because amongst cops, or maybe, you know, this is like a, you know, you can't like base the experiences of the men that Simon's like documented in his work, you know, and how they kind of go about it in their machismo, you know, not taking the work home with them. But I feel like this would be a very rare thing a cop would do, you know, like they really try to create that, you know, divide and distance and compartmentalize the job. So, I mean, Kima's obviously gone through tragedy and trauma in her work. So, and Cheryl's been around, you know, at the bars when she's telling stories in the lead up to her getting shot, Kima, that is, and of course, and, but it's kind of like, why, you know, why would she want to, you know, have her in such close proximity to her job? Or it's just like one, this is like her attempt to, you know, get her like, either way, she's going to say, wow, this is why you should do this job, or it's going to be such an extreme gesture that she'll just shut down Cheryl, that is, and leave Kima to do the job that she wants to do.
Right. Yeah.
It's like she's going for broke or something.
I mean, kind of signaling the oncoming disaster that's about to come with their impending breakup. Anyways,
all relationships involving cops, like partners.
Yeah.
It's like, it's all going to end in a disaster. So,
yeah. Well, all like
Chardine and Lester. No.
They stick together. And I mean,
that's such a new
yeah. I mean, we never see Bunk's wife, but they, well, I guess he does.
When he's not cheating on her. Yeah, that's it. Well, he's like, you know, that's a solid relationship. When he's not lighting bathrobes on fire and, you know, hooking up with Randy's future, foster mother.
So we can get into the Wire universe.
Well, they talk about in the new detail office how they're able to find out all the information, how their books are, you know, are open to the public, more or less, similarly to how they were able to find all these reports on Abon and his group, Lester and Perez on the paper trail. Of course, they bring up how there was some big racketeering case in New York City 5 years previously, but I couldn't find anything specific. Probably not the best way to start out these segments. Like, hey, they talk about this. Let me tell you how I did not find anything. But what would be, 3 years later, 2005,
right?
In context of this show, well, maybe it's 2003 by now in season two.
Yes, I think it'd be 2006.
Couple years.
Right.
A couple years later, in 2005, there was this huge racketeering case on the brought by the authorities up there in New York on the ILA. By that time in 2005, there were 45,000 members of the union. They were in bed with the Gambino and Genovese. Please step in.
I think it's Genovese.
Genovese. Okay, there you go. See? I mean, aside from your mwah, beautiful, this is your Italian heritage shining through. So I appreciate it. They were just basically kind of what we see here with the Greeks, all sorts of smuggling and so forth. So a whole lot of people, but that was up in New York, got charged. So, but it also in 1991, I think more in relation to Baltimore, there was also a huge case. Back then, there were 662,000 members of the ILA, nationally, of course.
Right.
The ILA is huge. All over the states, the Great Lakes, the Gulf, the East Coast, West Coast have members. So, they seem pretty happy about the results. 1991, the ILA, so they got off. But again, this is just another, little detail that can serve as a vessel to dive deeper into or read deeper into these racketeering cases and instances of corruption that seem pretty commonplace in the ILA. So, just a few general examples.
That's good.
But getting more specific here, I want to also just take this moment to make a correction. I got ahead of myself earlier on this season where I was talking about the lobbyists that the IBS was looking to get in touch with.
Right.
And I called him DiBiagio. I think I was just
adding an extra.
Yeah, exactly. So, as you were able to just correct me for the Genovese family, utilizing maybe some of your Italian, flair and heritage. I don't know why you didn't step in there, but, this is, of course, my fault, Willie.
I just wanted
to make a connection.
It was pure malevolence on my part. I just wanted to watch you flail.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, I know you get killy with the Willie, but... Now I'm like, oh yeah, DiBiagio. I need it to, sound like this to make this connection to Thomas DiBiagio, who was the state attorney or Maryland, prosecutor in charge of some corruption case involving my guy Ed Norris. So I was like, yeah, oh, corruption, DiBiagio. But it's of course DiBiago. So. It's never feels good when you have to let Prez correct you on some pronunciation or fact. So I'm like, no, why couldn't I have heard this from a stevedore themselves? I had to hear from Prez to learn that I'm wrong. No, but it doesn't feel good. So I feel like I'm off to a great start here, sharing some information with you.
Yeah,
Before I get into something I actually do know about, I also looked into the Talco shipping line, but was really unsuccessful. There was just one like LLC or something, but I think it really is a logistics company or something, but maybe I'll have more information on that for us too, Willie, since I seem to be very unsuccessful making connections with the dock and extrapolating details with the stevedores and so forth. Let's talk about something that I learned from a reference, which I'll tie into some geo shortly, but you know, where they're monitoring drug dealers in East Baltimore, Herc, Carver, and Kima, they mentioned O'Donnell Heights,
right,
which is the aforementioned place I want to talk more about in geography. But, it's like, of course, I have my frustrations with some of the placement I talked about last episode and blah, blah. But more importantly, in researching more about O'Donnell Heights, I came across an organization that was active in that area, basically without giving too much of the geography stuff away, because of course I want to dive into it more. It was just a project that was in Southeast Baltimore, still is for more or less, but there was a gang there called the Nickel Boys, and they made their money selling nickel bags, $5 bags of cocaine, and their placement in Southeast Baltimore was close to places like Dundalk and so forth. So, there was a very lucrative operation with people coming from the suburbs, mostly white people, to buy the drugs. It was a mixed project, which, of course, we'll get more into. But basically, some of the members of that drug organization had some pretty interesting nicknames, and there was eventually an indictment against the Nickel Boys. Members included Sleepy, there's someone named Bunky, another member was named Fonz, and of course, not to be left out, Cheese. So I just
there we
I
go, that, nice.
I found that, yeah, to be interesting. But in researching a little bit more about Cheese, I found that it wasn't necessary. It was a nickname that also functioned as his real last name. So his name was Alfred Cheese, and he was 34 at the time the Nickel Boys were busted in 1998. So they were pretty much all sentenced to 20 or more years in prison. There's a lot of violence taking place in this area. Of course, it being a high volume, high intensity drug trafficking area, there's a really high profile mass murder up in Northeast Baltimore, not far from O'Donnell Heights on the east side, where I think 5 women were murdered as part of like collateral and some drug bust gone wrong, where low level drug dealers, not necessarily these individuals, but, associated with drug gangs and stuff in O'Donnell Heights. When looking for some man who slighted them, but ended up killing, a bunch of women who were in the house and area where they went. So, well, also one of the locations in the project where they set up their drug shop was called The Hole. So I found that to be an interesting comparison or, parallel or connection. He did have a really long rap sheet, Alfred Cheese. He had 15 points on his record, whatever that meant back in the 90s. But it seemed like he really got railroaded. So, he got sentenced to life. He got 2 life sentences, I think, for 2 charges. One being, I think it was felon in possession of a firearm, which maybe that felon in possession got dropped and it just was operating, like having a firearm and some committing a crime, but it wasn't murder. It was just, that's what he was charged with. And then also, I guess, intent to distribute. He got caught with crack or drugs, so. Seemed like he got a late 90s crime build, is what I'm trying to say. So his appeals, I looked into Alfred Cheese's case in 2010. I think his last appeal or motion to get his sentence reduced was denied. And they just said, oh, well, you're, even if you didn't commit any murders, your history and the fact that you had a part in, paying money to someone who partook in violence. It's enough for you to get your life sentences. So crazy stuff, man.
I myself am ready to move on to All the Pieces Matter.
Let's do it.
So I just want to say right off the bat that, you know, we haven't seen a lot of mirror shots lately, which were so they're so prominent in season one, just for expressing the themes of self-reflection and, you know, gauging where each character was at and, you know, examining their own lives and taking stock of what they've done. But in this episode, we got two really exciting mirror shots.
Do tell.
In kind of interesting reflections, we got Nick catching his reflection on going into the diner where he's going down the bumpy path of becoming a drug distributor in his own neighborhood. And he's further straying from the, you know, honest worker that his dad taught him to be. And then we also have Kima catching herself in a distorted reflection when she goes into the strip club, where she's kind of grappling with her own identity and her own lustful desires of, you know, wanting to play the field when she is ostensibly supposed to be in this committed relationship with Cheryl. So yeah, just a little bit of interesting symbolism there from the filmmaking perspective that could or totally could not be valid at all in the eyes of Steve Schill, the episode's director, David Simon, and Ed Burns. But, you know, I'm just grasping at straws here.
Man, you better look in the mirror if you're playing with straws. Because you aren't, man. No. Well, as we kind of kicked off the top of the show with the death of D'Angelo at the crux of the episode, and, you know, such a major moment. We've talked about the previous major death scene with Wallace and the you know, the blowback or the ramifications of that for the actor themselves and, you know, the cast, and how, you know, these moments affect everyone. So I don't know. I know we've titled this segment All the Pieces Matter. And, you know, I think we've kind of gone our own route with some things, but it always is good to, you know, tie things back to the great work by Jonathan Abrams, All the Pieces Matter, because they had some, you know, he was able to include some really poignant commentary and how, you know, Larry Gilliard Jr. dealt with it and so forth. Because, of course, this being a show where the script isn't, I don't know if telegraphed is the right term, but, you know, the actors seem to be kept in the dark quite a bit by Simon and the writers as far as not reading, being able to read ahead. So just thinking back on the book and the interviews that Jonathan Abrams was able to brilliantly tie into, you know, gathering all the perspectives of D'Angelo's death, how I guess Larry Gilliard Jr. was walking by David Simon and maybe some of the producers, Nina Noble, I believe, or, you know, there was a group of them, but then Simon just came directly at him and it's like, hey, I got some bad news and good news.
Yeah.
It's right. Like, the bad news, it's like, well, the bad news is you're not going to be reading beyond this episode. It's like, okay, what's the good news? I wrote you really, like, you have a great death scene. It's like peak Psycho Simon.
Yeah.
It's like just hearing some of that back and forth and what it must have, you know, felt like to be Larry Gilliard Jr., who, you know, mentioned that he was really invested, of course, in this phenomenal character that he brought to life, and how, you know, the writing of this show is obviously so superb to a lot of else, you know, what's out there in Hollywood, and just coming to terms with that. And then Simon just gleefully, like, just kind of basking in how, yeah, it's like, you know, he's pleading for his life. You know? It's like, that's how it should be. Like, what?
One of the big, like, obviously one of the big, like, acting moments in this episode in particular comes from Omar being on the witness stand. Michael K. Williams has said that this is the favorites, his favorite, his personal favorite scene that he acted in this show. And I know you and I both watched this episode with the commentary, but yeah, is quite shocking. It's funny. Like Michael K. Williams admitted that he was like basically really hungover the morning that they filmed the courtroom scene in one of the most like legendarily acted scenes in the whole show. Dominic West was also chipping in on that on all that, saying like, well, you know, the great thing about acting on the telly is that they give you eye drops so that your eyes don't look red. And that's pretty much it. I mean, that's pretty much exactly. For those who don't know, Dominic West is British. And that's
I guess the whole like, don't trash the actors. I might work with these people. It's
got. What do you mean? That's exactly what he sounds like. I've been working on that impression tirelessly for hours.
Oh, I'm sorry, man.
Yeah.
Wait, would you say you worked on that accent as much as he worked on his Baltimore accent?
Well, obviously we're in the middle of a pandemic, so I can't work one-on-one with a dialect coach, but
for 3 years.
No, that's actually not exactly what he sounds like. I was being facetious, everybody. Please don't cancel me for trash talking the British accent. Dominic West is an incredible actor. There is another moment in this commentary that I feel like would perhaps get him.
Before you get into this, sorry, I'm totally redirecting you. Who was he out drinking with? Why was Michael K. Williams, you know, hungover?
Oh, I don't even remember the details.
Oh, you're making fun of the Brits. He was drinking with Idris Elba, who is a legendary drinker. Apparently, he once, I don't know what Michael K. Williams was trying to get into, because he didn't know apparently maybe that J.D. Williams once went up against Idris Elba claiming that Brits can't hold their liquor or something like that. Or J.D. Williams, I guess he never, you know, watched a Champions League game with the British club involved. It's like, what? British people not drinking? Like, can't hold their liquor? Literally, like, one of the most insane drinking cultures. But
I know, right?
Yeah. That is legendary. But sorry, man, I'm really sorry. But yeah, Michael Williams was calling out Idris Elba in the back, like, look at him, he's sleeping on the back row.
That's funny.
Oh, who you out having a point?
Yeah,
getting pissed.
See, that's probably a lot more in line in terms of the accuracy of the accents. My
yes, your mom is my dialect coach. No,
that was really great. But then also, so as I was saying, Dominic West, this commentary was recorded in a very different time, but he was like kind of making some decorative comments about the woman who played Nick's wife. He's saying like, oh my God, her breasts were fantastic.
Now, we also, of course, this court scene is magnificent, but it pales in comparison to I Miss Nick's Girlfriend's Tits. Yeah. Sorry. That was really bad.
Yeah. I mean, he really.
I'm sorry, man. But you think could get Dominic West canceled in this? Because I'm like, okay, yeah, it really just seemed like, you know, I mean, Michael K. Williams, too, like you said, this is a very like horny commentary / episode. So, you know, Jimmy's fondling mannequins in this episode. He gets,
right.
You know, he has a fuck for the road, quote unquote, with Elena. So. But yeah, it was, he said multiple things about
yeah
women in this.
Yeah. The thing that most clearly sticks out in my mind is he's like, oh my God, her tits were gigantic. No, that's not.
When has Dominic Glass turned into some drunk Australian dude, like hanging out after some meth binge?
Like, hey, you know, I'm an American. All those accents sound the same to me. It's just like what the stripper was saying in the club, like, oh, she had an accent. And she was like, this sounded Russian. Like, it's just like typical Americans thinking like, oh, yeah, all those accents sound the same. Every language that's not our own sounds the same. So give me a break. All right. I was born and bred in an undereducated nation.
I mean, first of all, this is the greatest country on earth and ever known to man.
Sorry. Yes, it is.
No, this is a very exceptional country, Willie. But I don't know, man. I think that the British accent that you're, I don't know what you're trying to do with it at this point, but it definitely, I mean, I see where you're going with it, you know, but I don't know if this is a take kind of in the same vein as, you know, these alcoholic stevedores. I'm like, they're having a recovery beer. Okay. But I mean, because literally it's like, they're just like, wow, how did they... You know, he's trying to make it all artistic to cover up his, you know, creepiness. But he's like, thank you, Bob Colesbury. Did you know that he casted her without even seeing her tits? Like, it was just a video of her fully clothed. Someone said, Michael K. Williams, I think he said that. He's wow, really? Well, yeah, they didn't find out about her breasts until she took her shirt off. Like, why would they know? Like, I guess, is that how casting couch is really a thing? I'm like, please don't let this come out about The Wire. I mean, I'd be upset if they did shady stuff like this, of course.
Yeah.
It's like, I mean, you're right, Dominic West. I mean, I was going to go with another moment that stuck out to me, since now this has devolved into, you know, what could get him canceled in today's, you know, 2020 commentary. Okay, this is going to sound, you know, harsh probably from my end and where my values may lie, but if we're just talking about explicit moments, I believe would be something that would be, you know, met with maybe some pushback. Of course, you know, his comments about women and, look at me. I'm just like Amy's breast. I don't even have enough respect to know the actress's full name and real name. I have IMDb open. I should know. But yeah, Jimmy says that he tried to do the Baltimore accent specifically, but I guess since he was in the homicide, unit or where they're answering real calls or real calls were coming through. And then he said, no, they said I sounded retarded. So, you know. I couldn't do the Baltimore accent. I had to do the East Coast. So I'm like, hey, dropping the R word.
Yeah.
Nowadays. That, but he also, I mean, I don't know, man. Pretty crazy.
It's no good.
These stories, but maybe we'll get back on track and just discuss like the,
yes.
I'm my rhythm, man. I keep interrupting you and like, it's all.
No, it's okay.
I'm so sorry, man. My wife's going to, man, she's not pleased with me doing that. I'm sorry, man. And I'm not either. It's fine. It's like, okay, sorry. I'm doing it again.
It's cool.
One more thing, Willie. I forgot to mention with that whole D'Angelo death is that in reading it, you're, you know, like reading back All the Pieces Matter, one of the key pieces of like input in that conversation surrounding, you know, that maybe conflict, you know, was Steve Earle. He's like, I just can imagine him like witnessing that. So he's like, he really thought that he could change David Simon's mind. Like I can just imagine Waylon like in character, you know, just observing the argument
right
by Larry Gilliard to try to convince David Simon, not like one of the more stubborn people, as we've learned from social media. It's like, you're not going to convince this guy to like not kill you because you think you can do so much. That's literally, you know, why you're on the shows. As Wood Harris said, it's like a horror show. The Wire is scary. You don't know what's happening next. And this is Avon Barksdale, man.
Yeah.
Here's another little tidbit I remember from that book. This is the first scene we see Beatty and Carver together, right? And
right.
Seth Gilliam and Amy Ryan went to the same high school. So they said it was
That's right.
Entertaining reunion being blocked together for the first time. It was kind of a moment. So they both went to High School of Performing Arts in New York. I guess it was pretty prominent because Michael K. Williams and Dominic West communicated, or they commiserated about their common fear of Seth, which is like, man, his training. But it was like in an acting sense, I guess.
Right.
But then also maybe his demeanor too. But I guess, you know, he had a very, he's a very polished actor, they felt, and someone they, you know, I guess it's a crazy dynamic I can't relate to, but it was like, must be, you know, like Michael K. Williams was scared of Michael Kostroff and vice versa. Michael K. Williams more so because of his, you know, prominence as an actor, I guess, working on lots of shows, Law and Order and so forth. And it seemed like Michael Kostroff's fear was just like, this dude has a scar and he seems intimidating. I'm thinking, is there nothing artistic about Michael K. Williams that intimidates you? Or maybe he said a lot of people thought that his scar was fake until they got up close. Like, oh, that's real.
Right.
By the way, I thought Michael K. Williams, he stopped drinking after, you know, his incident, because he was out drinking and he said that was out of character for him, or he got out of character when he was drinking on his 25th birthday, which led to him getting his, you know, getting slashed and scarred. But maybe I misinterpreted and he just said he was trying to be a tough guy when he was drunk. He didn't stop drinking because of it, but
yeah, maybe,
you know, this experience helped him therapeutically get over some traumas. Oh, let's talk about Dee and Rihanna's last interaction. There was, since we're talking about high school novels, we've read The Great Gatsby, that conversation where she told him to go stand up for himself and she wouldn't let him back in and lock the door, as you mentioned earlier, you know, to face the bullies that were going to surely beat him.
Right.
It reminded me of the novel Black Boy, the autobiography by Richard Wright.
Right.
Yeah. So I believe it's an autobiography. But yeah, it's about his experience growing up in Memphis and, you know, urban poverty and so forth. And there's a scene, or not a scene, but there's an excerpt or portion I remember. And I looked back on to try to find, and I found some free class workshop for, looked like middle school or something. You know, one of those like worksheets where you read the excerpt and then there's all these like theme. I'm thinking I could learn some things. Maybe I gotta go back to eighth grade to learn how to organize my thoughts for this project. But yeah, I'm like, man, there's some really intense parallels, because in Black Boy, he is sent to the store to buy groceries by his mom, and they're struggling with like food insecurity and so forth. His dad's left, and it's like, you know, he's in a really hard space. Trying to internalize all this as a young Black boy. And he's confronted by like a group of bullies on the corner, and they beat him, and he runs back to try to get help, you know, and seek refuge with his mother. But she essentially delivers a similar message to what Brianna said, you know, where she, you know, pretty much told him that he's on his own. He's got to come back with the groceries or else he's not coming back inside. And, you know, he was pleading to his mother to, you know, please, you know, have mercy on him. But instead she, you know, gives him a stick and tells him, you know, he's got to go fight. So he figures that, you know, his mom says she's going to beat him up, or like she reprimand him, you know, in more of a corporal punishment type of way. So either he could face the bullies and have a chance of fighting back, or face, you know, punishment by his mother, who he can't defend himself against, or he won't obviously fight back against, because he's outmatched and terrified and, you know, has some shame. But yeah, it was interesting. Yeah. Or it could just, you know, be I don't want to call it a trope, but, you know, it's such a powerful scene, but it's kind of something to hear maybe also in urban culture, like, you know, and it just proves to me why, if I ever thought of myself as a tough guy, I definitely was let in the house after getting beat up outside, but that's a whole different story. We can maybe share someday moving forward. Hey, maybe season four will have our time to shine, Willie, talking about our days.
Yeah, there we go.
On the streets. No. Mm. Here's like the main thing I wanted to talk about in this segment. Obviously an iconic court scene and dialogue between Levy and Omar. And I actually shared this with you like after I found this reference in this bizarre book I found on philosophy and The Wire. In this pretty brilliant work, essentially a collection of essays, I believe. And I'm trying to make sure I give credit to who wrote that piece. It's talking about the game and The Wire and so forth. But I think I'm in trying to format these notes, Willie. I deleted who I think his name was Ty, or they draw a parallel between a book that came out. It was written by Alexander Berkman, who was a 19th century anarchist. So it's like, you know, around that time, I guess the late 1800s, like the Haymarket Square riot, I think, or there's some anarchist, uprisings or some anarchist events. I don't know how to frame it, but basically, you know, I think anarchists were having a moment in that space in the late 1800s. But basically, Alexander Berkman, he wrote this book called Prison Memoirs of an Anarchist. It was about his time in the Western Penitentiary of Pennsylvania in Pittsburgh from 1892 to 1906. So yeah, he was in there for a minute. But I guess this reference was drawing the parallel between a conversation he had with someone named Lightning Al, who was a pro thief who we met in prison. And this is what was written in that book. Now and then, the best of us may fall, but it don't happen very often, and it's all in the game. This whole life is a game, Mr. Berkman, and everyone has his graft. Do you mean there are no honest men? I asked angrily. Pshaw, I'm just as honest as Rockefeller or Carnegie, only they got the law with them. Pretty, I don't know. I don't know how they came up with this comparison, but it's drawing on some themes, you know. Who's got the briefcase? Who's got the shotgun? It's all in the game, though, right?
Let's move into the Geo Genius then, too, to close this out.
Yeah. Okay, I'll try to just go through these little references here. They may or may not be in order, but they mentioned Sabaka has a house out in Glen Burnie. So as I mentioned, he and Ziggy, I'm assuming Ziggy lives with him. They live out in the suburbs, more or less. It's Arundel County. So it's southeast of actually Linthicum Heights, which is where Rafael Alvarez was raised, contrary to, you know, how it may seem he grew up in a hardscrabble local Baltimore Port neighborhood. But that was more his dad and grandfather. But yeah, he grew up out in the burbs, which is not far. It's just south of South Baltimore, Brooklyn Park and all that, Glen Burnie. So pretty close to the Patapsco and the ports and whatnot. Let's see what else. Oh, yeah, the detail confirms all their shenanigans last episode, how they're making all this progress with hand-to-hands and Greek Town, Highland Town, and O'Donnell Heights, which are all East Baltimore neighborhoods, kind of progressing out farther east from Highland Town, then onto Greek Town, and then, southeast of that is O'Donnell Heights, which I referenced a bit, and making some comparisons or potential parallels to the Nickel Boys and Old Cheese. So O'Donnell Heights, pretty interesting, was a pretty major project. Actually, in acreage, it was the second largest project, or as far as area concerned, it was 62 acres. So pretty freaking huge. About 900 units were initially constructed. So this was one of, I think, 11 complexes constructed, project housing complexes constructed around this time of World War II. And of course, just about all of them were temporary in design, but then ended up serving as long-term housing. So that only contributed to the blight and urban decay, as they weren't maintained properly and never intended to be lived in long term. So for about, the 20 years initially, you know, after they were constructed, it was a white project. So it was known as Hillbilly Hill. So good old Billy Land. You'll hear some old Conway Twitty out there, I'm assuming. But in 1967, they were integrated. So they became, an integrated project, more or less, which might seem, something unique. But in Baltimore, these kinds of things happen. And as we see in the relationships between black and white drug crews, even if they are in Pigtown instead of where they're actually supposed to be, on Southeast Baltimore. But these projects, I took a little cruise on Google Maps, and they even though some, essentially in 2007, some of them were raised, two-thirds actually, more than some, were raised, and it looked like some newer affordable housing units that are more modern, of course, were designed. But some of the old projects, I believe, while maybe up, kept up a little bit better over the years, are still there. And I could see, why some of these areas had such a tough reputation. But yeah, the late 90s seemed to be especially bad, a la the hole where the Nickel Boys dealt drugs out of. And in articles I found about them, I didn't get to read this entire expose from, I think, the 80s about just how bad O'Donnell Heights was, like a feature piece about it. But in the article about the drug dealing and gangs and so forth, a city maintenance worker was, he was really ashamed at how neglected these areas, had become. But I think there's politics involved, of course, like Armistead Gardens, which was more of an all-white project, which we talked about up by Chaps Pit Beef, was more well-maintained. So maybe the fact that, it became integrated and so forth, it led to the decay and, just funds being funneled elsewhere.
Right.
As far as not to the black populations that were now inhabiting the area. It kind of struck me when Michael K. Williams made a comment in the beginning, which really, of course, perked me up. And he said that he was riding around with a youth worker, as Michael K. Williams is really involved in these things, especially post-Wire. But maybe this was him getting his feet wet. But he said that the worker was making a house call to a neighborhood, and it was a white kid that he was checking up on or working with, and it was an all white neighborhood. And it really just shocked him, because Michael K. Williams, of course, growing up in New York City, also in the projects, had said that, of course, based on his upbringing and experiences up to then, he's never seen a white ghetto like that. And it really opened his eyes and made him appreciate season two more, and brought a lot of authenticity to some of the things being portrayed, as far as, maybe now he could look at Frog and all them like in a whole different light, even not interacting with them. But he said he was shocked. Any race could be, it just happened. Any race could be there. It just happened. It was all white neighborhood, but, he said it was pretty mind-blowing. I mean, of course, it's not necessarily unique to East Baltimore, which is where he said it was. He was like, it was East and it was South. It was Southeast. I'm like, Southeast Baltimore, O'Donnell Heights, maybe? but it could have been Dundalk. It could have been, Dundalk's a little more suburban, but as I said, O'Donnell Heights location, right? I think it was, east of the 95, and then west of Dundalk Avenue, and north west of Dundalk, which is like a more white working class area just above, or it could be ghetto area above what used to be Bethlehem Steel, of course. And then yeah, that just led to the drug market exploding because they were just so there's Aldona Heights. It's situated right along the highway, of course, like I just said. I'm repeating myself. Sorry. Okay. Thanks for bearing with me, bud. But, you know, the drug, it was basically also fueled by the demand of white suburban drug addicts. So just to, you know, the politics of the drug war, of course, on the forefront there. But the convenience of being able to just get off the highway and get your drugs and get back on it, you know, it's like, you know, but the main point, real working people and citizens had to live and exist in that environment. But Michael K. Williams also says the first time he saw real testers being distributed on another call with that youth worker friend, but in a different neighborhood, where he said, "What? This is," he's like, "I just lost it. Like, this is a real thing in New York. The drug dealer just, you know, you cop and then you leave." But it's like, I don't know, man. They think Simon was playing. Simon and Burns weren't. Jimmy, how's Jimmy a cop? Like, I don't understand. Dominic West, like, did he not go to like the academy? It's like, he's like, "Oh, really? Okay. The testers." I'm like, dude, you literally are investigating these guys. And he doesn't even know like
what a tester is.
Yeah, what a tester
that was
is.
Funny, yeah.
How do you, this guy is super British, man. I guess he never been to the ends, huh? Here's something else that you're going to find pretty interesting.
Yeah.
Central Avenue is brought up by Nick. He says that he doesn't want a war with Cheese to Spiros, who offers to just kill Cheese outright. He says, you know, I mean, aside from being usual racist Nick, like this, you know, some man, we'll just say, can maybe see me in a year from now or one of my friends outside a burger joint or getting gas on Central Avenue and just kill us. And I was thinking, you know, there's only one gas station I found on Central Avenue, and it's on Central and Fay, which is an east side thoroughfare that goes pretty close to the east side of downtown, which there's quite a bit of projects and so forth over there. So, but then again, Nick does have his hood pass, as we've learned. So his friends must too. So maybe they are getting gas over by Douglas Homes or whatnot. Oh, Willie, here's one of the main things I wanted to talk about. Remember, I think in episode 3, we talked about how Baltimore club music.
And, right. Yeah.
In the background of the pit. But we also talked about like the similarities or differences with Go-Go, which is brought up. And String, not a fan, true to his Baltimore roots. I'm like, that's not really a rivalry, D.C. and Baltimore. And String's like, I can't stand that shit. It's like, yeah, you should come on out to Oxon Hill. Like, the guy who is going to, you know, kill his supposed friend's nephew. It's like, yeah, like if I ever do something, he's all salty about DC. But yeah, that man who plays the middleman, I guess, or his cousin is the one who's going to kill D'Angelo, or he knows someone who.
Yeah, I wasn't too clear on the connection. I just like
it took me like 3 minutes to realize what the hell is going on. I'm like, oh shit, this is where Stringer's paying the bounty on D. But yeah, he references DC, it's not called Chocolate City, which of course, you know, was the nickname. And it's now called Drama City, which is also a novel, one of the standalone novels written by George Pelicanos. So. But yeah, Go-Go, man. Woo. What, as you told me, I'm, you know, I got pretty into it prior to this project taking off. You know, I mean, I've definitely heard it, especially learning more about that culture and stuff through Pelicanos. But pretty interesting genre, man. You told me it's the official music of DC, like literally the official music of DC.
Yeah, right. I think I read that on the Wikipedia page at some point.
Yeah.
Or maybe probably a more legitimate source.
For those of you who aren't familiar with Go-Go, it's definitely worth checking out. I think it's just like also related to geography, you know, being DC it's not officially the South, but it's definitely when people discuss Baltimore as, you know, almost a Southern city, DC more so has that. Because the guy also references Bama's, same old Bama's, right? And then he says the iconic, like, same old soup just reheated. And then we heard Wallace talk about the Bama's, which drove him away from his grandma's house back to the pit to his inevitable death. So damn Bamas, man. Nah. And of course, it's just a DC term for more off-brand people in relation to style or whatnot. But sorry, I'm getting all sidetracked, getting excited about Go-Go. Yeah, it's like a crazy mixture. What I mean, like, it's got hip-hop, jazz, rock, funk, right?
Yeah,
gospel, it's even.
It's very eclectic. If you guys haven't heard any.
Yeah, check it out. They got some pretty prominent, like, Northeast Groovers, I think. I better know. TCB, I think, is a Go-Go band. And then, of course, Backyard Band, my favorite. And Juan Big G Glover, Slim Charles himself.
That's right.
Yeah, so he's a part of that. It's all like instrumentals, all for the most part. I mean, there's, you know, they got people rapping a little bit. And Juan, or let's just say Big G, no disrespect. He's kind of like, he's a vocalist. He's also a really good musician. I mean, he came up in Columbia Heights learning. I think he plays like a wind instrument or no, a brass instrument. So it's like the New Orleans, like related to maybe a second line type deal, but it's like a DC equivalent. That's probably a terrible comparison. Please cut that out now. But yeah, it's amazing. I mean, I think around this time they would have been blowing up too. And two, okay, there's a lot of debates. One of their famous songs, Pretty Girls, which was sampled by Wale in his hit 2009 song featuring, I believe, Gucci Mane, or maybe it was just Wale first and it was like the remix. I think it was a remix with Gucci and all that. But they sampled Pretty Girls and everyone's like, oh, I heard this. Like if the late 90s had YouTube, you're like, no, honey, it was 2002. So I don't know. I'm like, okay, which timeline do I go with? But yeah, I mean, they would have been blowing up in DC right around this, you know, second season. But the guy references Oxon Hill, which I've learned is it's a suburb just southeast of Southeast DC. So it's over, I think it's Maryland. It's northeast of Alexandria, Virginia. So, but I believe that as of late, I don't know, back around the early 2000s, like the reference, but I know, well, I know the reference is, you know, related to music venues, as the guy says, but the context more so. I've heard like recently, or maybe, you know, this applies, of course, 2003, early 2000s, but it's where a lot of venues had to be moved because while Go-Go's not necessarily like inciting gang or violence, you know, or those sort of neighborhood beefs, its lyrics aren't, you know, like necessarily aggressive or glorifying like the street culture, but there are segments where they'll have like breakouts because a lot of it's kind of like not, I don't want to say jam band because that sounds too simplistic, but you know, it's like songs can last 15 minutes. So they're just kind of jamming out.
Riffing, yeah.
Yeah. Riffing. And yeah, there you go. Riffing. And people like Big G might, you know, say like, oh, like throw up your hood or, you know, represent where you're from, but it's a party atmosphere more so.
Right.
But apparently like violence or things like that could erupt. And of course it being like a prominent piece of black DC culture, maybe was more harshly discriminated against by the white police and whatnot as well. Yeah. So they were eventually, I believe, you know, places like Oxon Hill, what I'm trying to say is, you know, came about because the venues and parties were steered out of the city of or the district of Columbia. So they had to find other venues. So it's like, Linden Avenue, where D grew up, where D was getting his ass whooped and not let in the house. It's a street that runs from basically... God damn it. Yeah. It runs through Reservoir Hill, Linden Avenue. So, I mean, I was cruising it on the maps and, Reservoir Hill, it was like a historic neighborhood, pretty upper middle class black neighborhood, I believe. But yeah, it runs from North Avenue all the way to Druid Lake. So, it's like just like upper west side Baltimore. So it looks pretty nice. I mean, I'm sure, you know, it's got its tough spots, Linden Avenue, but it's kind of a lot of older architecture. It's not the row house kind of urban decay scenes that you'll see in areas like Upton or where Omar might be staking out a stash house. So, just like a lot of big units or old, older houses that look like they've been turned into duplexes or apartment buildings, but they're all pretty well kept for the most part, even if Kim Classic has other things to say. Well, that's where she was up in. She was on White Lock, but it wasn't, you know.
Yeah.
She's just like nice. There's nice streets right next to it, but she chose an empty old street to try to.
In her campaign ad.
Yeah.
Yeah. She lost.
I guess she can't, you know, make Baltimore great again or whatever she wants to do. Shout out to Brandon Scott, youngest mayor in history. Chardine references Harford Road.
Right.
So that's where I believe, yeah, the night shift club with the Russians is located. Okay. So Harford Road actually is where Central runs up to meet its end on East Preston and then turns into Harford Road, which heads out of the northeast side of the city. So going up past Bel Air Edison, you got the Clifton Park Golf Course, and by Montebello Lake, I believe it's called, and the neighborhood Beverly Hills. Ooh, they got Beverly Hills in Baltimore.
Damn.
And then it runs all the way up to Lock Raven Reservoir Park. Ooh, that sounds like pretty cool. And it turns into Highway 47. So if we ever take our trip, Willie, maybe we'll have to cruise up Harford Road, go check out what Lock Raven Reservoir Park. I don't know if it's spooky like or I don't know. And our final stop this episode, Willie, I know you're really interested to hear the background of where the stripper and who's informing Kima of all these. You remember her. Hey, Michael K. and Dominic, they may have redeemed themselves a bit from their comments about Amy. And like, I was just thinking about, you know, okay, when's it coming? When's their comment going to be made? They're like, oh, I love her. You know, she just really kills it this scene. Give her the Emmy. I just love her. Like, her delivery is just, everything about her acting is just amazing. So I'm like, oh, see?
They're very gracious. Yeah.
Yeah. But my focus here is that she's from Westport, which is also known as the Patch. It's a West Baltimore. It's kind of been a interesting area. Also kind of, as you see, maybe low income areas getting choked off by highways that are built right through them. So, I mean, you got the Westport homes on one side of the 95, I believe. And then, and you got like, I guess the neighborhood of Westport, it's kind of, it runs up right against the Patapsco, the middle branch of the Patapsco River. So, it's a tough area. So yeah, that lady, you know, she's doing her thing over at the club, hustling, making her money, but, you know, I don't think she's going to get anywhere with Kima, with Cheryl there. I don't think Kima's going to get anywhere with Chardine. So. There's Lester there. So.
Right.
All right, Willie. That's some geo.
All right. So thank you very much, everybody, for tuning in. We always appreciate you sticking with us to the end. You all are great. We're very appreciative. I'm tired.
It's toasty in there, Willie.
If you want to donate to us, that web address is anchor.fm/thegodswillnotsaveyou/support. Big shout out to everybody again. If you want to follow us on social media, we're active on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
Yeah, and if you feel like connecting to us via email, our address is thegodswillnotsaveyou@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. Comments, questions, concerns.
Exactly. And also shout out to Andre Tesnes. Did great work on that podcast logo with his graphic design skills.
Yeah, he sure did. Thanks, bud. And shout out, as always, to our guy Mostart. Came through with the original music that he allowed us to slap onto our project here. Makes it sound great. So also some bumper music for one of our segments. So
there you go.
Thanks again, Mostart. Check him out, mostart.com.